From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Thompson was the guitarist who rocked the British folk rock group Fairport Convention. But his music became more moody, more idiosyncratic when he left. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Thompson about his new album, Rumor and Sigh. Also, we talk with Milton Viorst, Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker, about his recent trip to Iraq. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Life's Too Short, the new album by Marshall Crenshaw. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today the United States has incontrovertible evidence that Iraq has violated the Gulf War ceasefire by refusing to permit United Nations inspectors to visit a suspected Iraqi nuclear site. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush met this morning with his national security advisors on how to respond to Iraq's refusal to allow international observers to inspect a base believed to be a nuclear facility. Initially, he told reporters only that he was very concerned about the matter. However, after reports that Iraqi officials had used weapons to deter observers from inspecting a second site, President Bush had harsher words for Saddam Hussein.
We can't, from the U.S. standpoint, permit this brutal bully to go back on what was a solemn agreement and to threaten people that are there under UN jurisdiction. And that's exactly what he appears to have done. And the man has no shame.
Mr. Bush refused to discuss possible U.S. options. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The European community sent a delegation to Yugoslavia today to try to mediate between the federal government and the secessionist republics of Slovenia and Croatia. EC leaders also threatened to freeze more than $1 billion in aid to force the federal government to resolve the crisis peacefully. The EC delegation was composed of the foreign ministers of Luxembourg, Italy, and the Netherlands. The EC mission came as the federal government and the Republic of Slovenia announced that they had agreed on a ceasefire. Ethnic violence was reported to be continuing in Croatia, where at least 8 people have been killed and 21 wounded since the republic declared independence on Tuesday. The Senate passed compromise legislation today on gun control. By a vote of 67 to 32, the Senate approved an amendment that would require a national waiting period for the purchase of handguns. The vote is defeat for the National Rifle Association, which lost a similar battle in the House last month. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Last night, the Senate defeated a measure aimed at stripping the so-called Brady Bill waiting period from the anti-crime legislation. Today, even more senators endorsed the waiting period under a compromise proposed by the leadership. Under the compromise, the waiting period is pared down from 7 days to 5 working days and would be lifted in 2.5 years if a national instant background check system is fully operational. Majority Leader George Mitchell asked both rural and urban senators to give a little.
The people we represent are more important than either the media pressures or the competing demands of the lobbying groups involved here. I believe we've developed the least intrusive, most effective way of meeting a common goal.
President Bush has threatened to veto the bill over its gun control provisions, but has hinged it on passage of certain criminal justice reforms which are included in the bill. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 28 points to close at 2,906. This is NPR. Transworld Airlines' plan to avoid bankruptcy got support today from a federal appeals court, which approved the airline's sale of 4 of its London routes to American Airlines. TWA sold the routes for more than $550 million and would like to use the money to buy back some of its $3 billion debt. TWA's unions claim that the loss of the valuable routes will ultimately kill the airline. The suit was joined by the city of St. Louis, where TWA is based. The appeals court judges voted 2-1 in favor of the sale. On Monday, a special advisory commission will give President Bush its list of military bases recommended for closing. With the deadline rapidly approaching, the commission's list still needs work. NPR's Kay McFadden reports.
By late afternoon, it appeared that the base closing commission would reserve its voting on the biggest and most controversial sites until Sunday. Earlier, members made some headway on a handful of less significant Army and Navy bases, deciding in almost every case in favor of Defense Department recommendations. now on the commission's list for downsizing are Rock Island Arsenal, Letterkenny Army Depot, Midway Island Air Facility, and Aviation Support Command in St. Louis. For closing, naval sites at Puget Sound Sand Point, Davisville, Rhode Island, Moffett Field, and Hunters Point, Treasure Island. A finalized list from the commission will be delivered to President Bush on Monday. The president has until July 15th to approve or reject the entire list, which then will be passed on to Congress for a 45-day period of examination. At the Capitol, I'm Kay McFadden.
Japanese officials today played down the importance of a survey showing that Japanese auto parts are far cheaper in the United States than they are in Japan. The survey bolstered critics who said that Japan's domestic auto parts market is non-competitive. Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher said yesterday that Japan has closed its domestic parts market to foreign companies and is victimizing its own consumers. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most important folk rock groups has been the British band Fairport Convention, founded in the late 60s. They started a new trend by playing traditional ballads from the British Isles on rock instruments and original rock songs influenced by traditional music. The person who was most credited with rocking this folk music was the guitarist Richard Thompson. He left the band for a solo career and performed with his wife Linda until they broke up in the early 80s. Richard Thompson is one of those great talents in music who never quite crosses over into the mainstream market, but many consider him among the best songwriters in rock and one of the most original guitarists. And on his new album, Rumor and Sigh, you can hear how expressive his singing is. Thompson lives in Los Angeles now and is about to go on tour. From his new album, this is a song about someone who's just gotten out of jail and feels so good he's going to take someone apart. It's called I Feel So Good.
Somebody's heart tonight. I feel so good. I'm gonna take someone apart tonight. They put me in jail for my deviant ways. 2 years, 7 months, and 16 days. Going back on the street in a purple haze. I feel so good.
Richard Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I think the song we've just heard, I Feel So Good, is, well, in its own way, deals with a kind of crisis that I think a lot of rock performers, rock songwriters get into in their late 30s or in their 40s. And that is when you're past the stage of youthful anger and rebellion, how do you capture the kind of energy, frustration, and passion that you want to put into music? And you've done that in this song by writing in persona.
Yeah, I think that is a good way of doing it. I've never really enjoyed, you know, that thing where you write about your own life. I've always found it a bit far too, you know, introspective. So it's interesting to use, you know, personas as a device and to use other characters as a way of expanding what you're able to write about.
How did you come up with this character?
I'm not very sure. It's a bit worrying, really, to think about it. It's a very worthless kind of character. You know, it's a fellow who's just come out of prison and he's not likable. If you make someone the subject of a song, you're almost suggesting that they're a hero, and this person definitely isn't a hero or even an anti-hero. He's a very unredeemed character. He may be slightly better than the society that created him, but I'm not sure that even that's a good thing. Very kind of morally bleak song. I think it's a song that throws the listener back on his own morality.
Do you ever write fiction?
You mean
outside of songs?
Oh, sit down and write fiction. Yeah, I suppose so. I write short stories. I'm not sure they're any good.
Because your songs remind me of short stories.
Yes, they kind of are. You're even more limited than you are in a short story, really. It's very hard to get character development into a song because a song's 3 minutes. And I think in a song you have to use devices to suggest a bigger picture, perhaps. You have to write very succinctly, and you have to use what's been called the keyhole effect, where it's as if you're looking through a keyhole at a very small part of something, and and you recognize the bigger picture from the small bits.
Have your stories ever been published?
Oh, I wouldn't show them to people.
Why not?
I don't think they're any good.
Oh. Now, writing songs in persona, writing stories about characters and songs, a lot of that was done in traditional English ballads, and that's the kind of music that's always influenced you. Do you feel that you've drawn on that in being confident in telling stories through songs or in describing characters in songs?
It's certainly a help to know the vocabulary, the vocabulary and the kind of imagery that's available from there is a wonderful jumping-off point to create something contemporary. There's something about the resonance of the language that gives you almost, you know, instant reference points and instant success in trying to do something new.
Now, a lot of the English ballads were stories of murder and death and jealousy and deviance and imprisonment.
Things haven't changed too much.
Right. Now, I want to play something else from your new record, and this may or may not be a persona song. I mean, this is a song about being left by a lover, and there's, you know, this one could go either way. I don't know if this is autobiographical or not. Tell me something about writing this song.
Which song is this?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
You have to tell me first.
That's right.
I misunderstood. You know, it's just a piece of imagination. I suppose it's based on, you know, a lot of common human experience. Everyone has felt like that, and everybody's has been dumped, and everyone's had a hard time with relationships. So, you know, it's just a love song.
Well, let's hear it. And this is I Misunderstood from Richard Thompson's new album, Rumor and Sigh.
She said, darling, I'm in love with your mind. The way you care for me, it's so kind. Love to see you again, I wish I had. Laughing as she brushed my cheek. Why don't you call me Angel? Maybe next week. Promise now, crush your heart and hope to die. But I misunderstood. But I misunderstood. She was saying good luck. She was saying goodbye.
Well, is the line I thought she was saying good luck, but she was saying goodbye, is that the first thing that came to you in the song?
I'm not sure. I think the kind of guitar hooky riff was the first thing that I came to. I wrote it very quickly, so I'm not sure how things happened. I think also when you're writing, you're not really aware of what you're doing, which is kind of wonderful, really. It's like something else takes over and you're not responsible. So I'm really not responsible.
Now, you said before when I asked you about short stories, you said, oh, do you mean writing while I'm sitting down? So are you usually writing songs while you're driving or walking or...
I don't know, really. I don't know, but perhaps some element of discomfort is very important in writing something. You know, if I'm comfortably sitting at a desk and nothing seems to happen, if I'm standing up pacing the room, it's far more effective. If I'm crouching on the floor, it's more effective. Walking down the street is better. Driving's good. You know, has to be something going on, I think.
I want to ask you some things about your background. Now, your father was... a detective in Scotland Yard, do I have that right?
He was, yeah.
Now, how much did he tell you about his work?
Hardly anything. He wasn't really allowed to.
Oh, so do you know if he ever worked on any celebrated cases?
Oh, yeah, he tells me now. he did a lot of stuff. He was on what was called the Murder Squad for many, many years.
What's that?
It's the team that investigates the murders in
oh, the Murder Squad.
Yeah,
oh.
in central London. What do you think I said?
I thought you said the Motor Squad. I thought he investigated motorcyclists or something.
Sorry, one of us has an accent problem. Yes. You know, he was on that for a long time. You know, and they sort of move you around. I'm sure they do the same thing here. You know, that you spend so many years on one department, then they move you to Vice or, you know, drugs or something. You know, they keep moving you around to stop you being corrupt.
My guest is British singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. He has a new album called Rumor and Sigh. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Thompson is my guest. Now, a lot of British rock performers were inspired by the British blues revival. What effect did that have on you?
I probably went the other way. I think I was slightly repulsed by the blues revival.
Repulsed?
Well, I've always, you know, since I was about 11 or 12, I was listening to the blues, you know. And when the blues revival came along, there was suddenly like thousands of British kids playing, you know, what were really inferior versions of Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King and Otis Rush. And I thought, well, this can't be right. You know, this isn't really any good. This is always going to be nothing more than a pale imitation of this wonderful music. You know, kids living in the suburbs of Manchester, England, are never really going to capture it, because, you know, there's things that you can't know, there's experiences you can't have about America and about being black and that way of life. You know, so I sort of went the other way. Really, I think the blues revival and the popularity of soul music in Britain in the 60s really drove Fairport to traditional music, really, to an indigenous form of music.
So when you turned the other way and found music that was traditional in your country, the kind of folk ballads that you drew on, was that a return for you to that kind of music, or was that a brand new discovery of it?
It was a bit of both. I think we knew about it, you know, sketchily, really. We'd always, you know, hung out in folk clubs and listened to traditional performers, and we had a bit of it in childhood, and they ram a bit of it down your throat at school, you know. But actually, to really understand it and get into it, we had to do quite a lot of research. We had to do a lot of learning. We had to spend a lot of time with traditional musicians to learn our stuff, really.
What did you want to keep from rock and keep from traditional ballads when you merged the two?
Oh, good question. I think simplicity from rock music, simplicity and almost crudeness, roughness, and excitement and energy, seemed to me the great things about rock and roll. The thing that I think jazz rock, for instance, hasn't got. Jazz rock has taken all the wrong things from rock music and ditched all the good stuff, which is why, for me, it's less satisfying than traditional jazz. And from traditional music, you know, the indigenous reverberation that it has for British people, the quality of the language, and the excitement and the aptness of the rhythms, you know, as a musical vehicle and as dance music.
Why did you leave the band when you did?
I was writing a lot of songs that didn't seem to have any place in the band. It was very difficult for me to take those songs because they seem really rather eccentric songs, or rather bizarre songs. But it was,
like Henry the Human Fly?
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that ended up on Henry the Human Fly, you know, which is a very eccentric album. And but it was a direction that I really wanted to explore, and it seemed it'd be better, I'd have more time to work on it, if I was outside of the band. You know, I was reluctant to leave because they were all great friends, and we still are great friends. But you know, bands have to change.
For many years, after the Fairport period, you performed and recruited with your wife, Linda Thompson. And I think a lot of people assumed that the songs that you were singing were personal songs about your relationship together. I'm wondering if that is something you feel like you would never want to do again. In other words, to really sing with someone who you had that close a relationship and to sing songs about a relationship together.
First of all, I'd say that the songs really weren't about a relationship, whatever people might think. you know, again, the songs were fiction. What was going on in the subconscious? I mean, I don't know. And but there's nothing deliberately written about, you know, people. Obviously, if you're writing for a man's voice and a woman's voice, you have to write some songs from a woman's point of view. So. If you're writing about relationships, then you know you have her angle, then you have his angle, and it almost looks as if you're writing a you know a kind of soap opera. But would I like to do it again? It's difficult, you know. Like all, I think it was. It's a difficult thing to sustain, you know, a career and a marriage at the same time. Where you're in such close proximity all the time, you know, you're working together and you're at home together. Very hard thing to do. I wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah. After you had broken up, you were still committed to a tour that you were scheduled for, so you were performing on stage after the breakup, and from what I know, it was a very rough tour for you. What was that like?
very rough. It was a difficult thing to do. We shouldn't actually have done it. I think it was unfair on both of us and on the band and on everyone concerned. I suppose audiences got some kind of a frisson from watching maybe, but I think it was just a little too gory, really.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Thompson, and he has a new album called Rumor and Sigh. You became a Sufi Muslim, do I have that right?
Just Muslim would be a more accurate description.
Oh, okay. And how did you first become a Muslim? When was it, and what led you in that direction?
I had some musician friends who were Muslims, and I was very impressed by them as people. You know, I really liked whatever quality they had, which is, I suppose, kind of indefinable, you know, that they had a certain kind of nature about them, certainly kind of a way of carrying themselves that I was very impressed with, and I wanted to be like them.
Some people might find it paradoxical that years after becoming more spiritual, you're writing these really dark songs. Do you find any irony in that, or does that make perfect sense to you?
Not really, no. You know, I might have spiritual aspirations. I mean, again, you know, I hate to, you know, to publicize, you know, this aspect of me. You know, it's kind of, you know, the private side of a human being. I'm a rock and roll musician, and you know, I'm full of, you know, doubts and worries and all this kind of stuff. You know, all this being a human being business, you know, gets expressed in the music. And also, I try and express what I see around me. And it's a difficult age for people, you know. It's an age of real frustration for people and real disappointment for people. You know, there's terrible things going on, and I think I really have to write about that.
Is rock and roll accepted in Islam?
Is Islam accepted in rock and roll? Is it accepted? That's a good question. I think we might need about 4 hours to answer that one. It's a difficult question.
Well, let me get back to your new record, Rumor and Sigh, and play another song from it. And this is called God Loves a Drunk. It's a terrific song. Would you say something about writing it?
I've never really equated you know, spirituality with being sober. You know, I never liked those sort of, you know, TV evangelist types. You know, or the chaps who come and knock on your door, and they're all very neat and clean. They've got sort of polyester suits on and these very tidy haircuts, and they're very clean shaven and well presented. You know, I don't like all that. You know, I really don't like it. The people I think of it as being spiritual that I've ever met in my life have actually been rather wild and outrageous almost. And they couldn't care less about, you know, what people think of them or what they look like, or, you know, they don't care about, you know, what they possess and all that kind of stuff. And I think that that's really what the song's about, you know. The drunk is, in a sense, much freer and wilder than the rest of society.
Can you still drink as a Muslim?
I don't drink at all.
Yeah, but so it's just that you don't mind other people doing it.
I think some of the more interesting people I know actually drink to excess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a medicine for people sometimes. You know, in this society, there's a lot of pain. And it's like a medicine, you know. It's a destructive medicine, and it's killed a lot of people I know, a lot of friends of mine. But it's something to turn to, you know. It's a way out of the pain.
Well, let's hear your song, "God Loves a Drunk."
Will there be any bartenders up there in heaven? Will the pubs never close? Will the glass never drain? No more DTs, no shakes and no horrors. The very next morning you feel right as rain. 'Cause God loves a drunk, lowest of men, like the dogs in the street and the pigs in the pen.
That's Richard Thompson from his new album, Rumor and Sigh. This is a real, instrumentally, you know, it's a real basic, like, man and his guitar kind of song. Do you like to occasionally, I mean, there's some really interesting production on this new record, but this is like an example of the record at its sparest.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like to save room in your repertoire for that kind of spare work?
I think so. I think it's very powerful to strip things down and be direct. I've always admired Hank Williams, who I think was one of the great songwriters and singers of the 20th century. And the thing that I learned from Hank Williams is just simplicity and directness. He's so straight from the heart to the heart, and that's a wonderful thing. And you can really reach people very directly in that way, I think. I do a lot of acoustic shows, you know, when I'm not working with a band. And you can certainly put lyrics across to people very, very strongly with just, you know, man and guitar.
Richard Thompson's new album is called Rumor and Sigh. His tour starts July 5th in Portland, Maine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How much of Baghdad was destroyed by the war? Why did Saddam Hussein go to war when the armies of so many countries were ready to fight against him? Why is he still in power? These were some of the questions on the mind of journalist Milton Viorst when he set out for Iraq in the spring. Viorst is the Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker. Coming up, he reports on his trip. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Life's Too Short, the new album that may turn Marshall Crenshaw into more than just a cult artist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that there's no question that Iraq is violating Persian Gulf War ceasefire terms. Officials say that members of a UN inspection team have been refused entry for a third time to Iraqi sites which reportedly contain nuclear weapons material. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
Ralph Acheus, the chairman of the UN commission responsible for locating and destroying Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, sent a letter to the Secretary General today. He reported that inspectors were refused entry to a military transportation facility east of Fallujah. He said that trucks packed with objects from the facility left the site despite requests by the team leader that no vehicles or equipment be moved. After the team took photographs of the movement, the Iraqi military fired small arms into the air and tried to seize the cameras, but no injuries were reported. Twice this week, the UN commission was denied access to the Abu Ghraib army barracks near Baghdad. And yesterday, Security Council's president told Iraq's UN ambassador that inspectors want to see the nuclear material taken from that site. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
According to the Iraqi news agency, Saddam Hussein has now ordered officials to cooperate fully with UN teams inspecting Iraqi nuclear sites. In Yugoslavia, an apparent ceasefire has been declared in Slovenia. The president of the breakaway republic says an agreement in principle to a ceasefire declared by the federal government has now been accepted. According to a government official, at least 100 people have been killed or injured in fighting this week. Even though the federal army is much larger and better equipped than local militia units, government officials say that there was heavy firing against army troops. President Bush says that he's down to a handful of choices in naming a replacement for retiring Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports from Kennebunkport, where Mr. Bush is spending a long weekend.
The president, speaking to reporters on board Air Force One, said while he had not made his decision yet, he was near to making one. Mr. Bush said he does not think there should be a quota system that would pressure him into replacing Marshall with another black justice, and he said the naming of a minority nominee should not be viewed as filling a quota. The president said he wanted to move quickly on naming his nominee so he could avoid, in his words, a lot of needless lobbying and pressure. National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport, Maine.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 28 points to close at 2,906.18 on volume of 163 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. The Russian Federation has challenged the Soviet government over a resolution directed at laying the foundations for a market economy. Instead, the Russian parliament has approved a counter-resolution. Under Prime Minister Pavlov's plan, the central government would keep broad economic powers, and a federal tax system would start next year. But the Russian government says the order cuts into the republic's independence and goes against a recent agreement between Soviet leader Gorbachev and 9 of the 15 republics. A jury in St. Paul, Minnesota, has found Walter Moody guilty on all counts, including first-degree murder, in the pipe bomb deaths of a judge in Alabama and a civil rights attorney in Georgia. The jury deliberated for less than 12 hours before delivering its verdict. Kate Smith of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Prosecutors described Walter Leroy Moody as a cowardly but dangerous terrorist.
a man who, after being convicted in 1972 of possessing a pipe bomb, launched an all-out war against the legal system, which culminated in the pipe bomb killings of a federal judge and civil rights attorney. Defense attorneys for Moody had argued that the government's case was based on circumstantial evidence and that there was no physical evidence linking Moody to the 1989 pipe bombings. Jurors found Moody guilty of 71 separate counts, some involving transportation of explosive materials across state lines. Others included sending threatening letters through the mail. Federal District Court Judge Edward Devitt could sentence Walter Leroy Moody to a maximum of 5 consecutive life sentences. For National Public Radio, I'm Kate Smith in St. Paul.
The nation's index of leading economic indicators climbed 0.8% in May for the 4th straight rise. The index is used to predict economic activity 4 to 6 months from now. The category showed a drop in the index, including consumer confidence. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest Milton Viorst is the Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker. Before the war, he'd traveled to Iraq several times. He returned in the spring to see what had changed and what had remained the same. Viorst reported on his trip in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker. Iraq is suspected of hiding some of its remaining nuclear weapons material in violation of the UN ceasefire agreement. Today, President Bush said there is incontrovertible evidence that Iraq violated the ceasefire by refusing to allow UN inspectors to tour a site where nuclear materials are suspected to be hidden. The president called Saddam Hussein a brutal bully, but would not say what the U.S. might do in response. But in today's New York Times, it was reported that administration and military officials have been discussing possible military options for dealing with Iraq's bomb-making capabilities that survived the war. I asked Viorst what he thought about the military option to enforce the U.N. agreement.
Well, I think we've probably dealt with Iraq with enough force. I think we ought to try doing a little negotiating, which we didn't do from the very beginning. I don't think we have to deceive ourselves. Saddam Hussein is a tough guy. He wound up with this war in far better shape than anybody anticipated he would be able to do. I'm sure he's playing every card he possibly can, and conceivably even the nuclear card. I don't have any inside information on that. But I think that force ought to be a last resort, as I felt it should have been, even in this war. I think we have to engage in some honest negotiation and try that. If it doesn't work, then we think of what else there is to do.
Well, the resolution to the end of the war required Iraq to dismantle all of its nuclear facilities. So the fact that it's been hiding nuclear capabilities is in violation.
Yes,
of the
I agree with that, and
war.
I think it ought to be taken care of. I don't have any inside information. I'm willing to accept at face value the fact that they conceivably are hiding nuclear materials. But I think that before we go about this with more bombing, that we ought to try to work it out in some reasonable fashion.
Let me ask you though about negotiations, since the presence of more nuclear materials shows what a liar Saddam Hussein can be. How do you think about honest negotiations again?
I think honest negotiations assume that people lie and that measures are taken to confirm to, what's that word, to...
ratify?
Not just to ratify, but forms of aerial surveillance and 10 other kinds of technological facilities we now have at our disposal to make sure that the terms of the agreement are kept. This has been true in all our negotiations with the Soviet Union. We assumed they were not going to operate honestly, and so we took the verification procedures as essential to an agreement. And I think that should also be applied to Iraq. We did not contemplate bombing Moscow, and I don't think we should contemplate bombing Baghdad. We've done more than enough of that already.
Let's talk about your recent trip to Iraq. What were the dates of your trip?
I was there during almost the entire month of April.
Were you surprised that the bombing seemed to be as precise as the military told us it was?
I was very surprised. I am old enough to remember, even though a few years later, some of the damage that was done to the cities of Europe in World War II, and certainly I expected it, and I think even our military people were kind of surprised at how well they did. Talk about pinpoint bombing, surgical strikes, and all those other words which we laughed at during Vietnam. I must say our people have done a remarkable job of perfecting those procedures, and those terms now genuinely do apply.
Were your friends and sources any more or less intimidated by the government, and were they any more or less free with the information that they gave you?
Well, they talked a lot more, but even during the period that I was there, as time has passed and Saddam has actually rebuilt his structure, I think they became more cautious. I was surprised when I got there at the beginning of April of how ready practically everybody I stumbled into was to denounce Saddam. People were genuinely angry at him. Maybe they supported him against the United States in terms of not caving in to all of these threats and blusters that President Bush inflicted upon him. There was a certain amount of support for him. But at a certain point, they recognized that Saddam really did a pretty dumb thing to think that he could stand up against the power of the United States, and particularly the United States with its 30 allies.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Milton Viorst. He's the Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about his recent trip to Baghdad. This is Fresh Air. Milton Viorst is my guest, Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. The Bush administration had really hoped that Saddam would be overthrown from within. Obviously, that hasn't happened. Why do you think that hasn't happened?
Well, I think that it was incumbent upon the Bush administration to learn something about Iraq. The reason it didn't happen, the ostensible reason it didn't happen, is because he has this huge bath party and this huge secret service, which imposes a kind of mean, brutal discipline throughout the entire society. And it's very effective. It works very well. He has this huge bureaucracy, which depends upon him for its support, its money, its social prestige, and all the rest, and it works very well. But I think even more important than that, the kind of thing that it was incumbent upon our government to recognize if what we expected was for the Iraqis themselves to overthrow Saddam is that this is a country which is divided basically into three major population groups. The Shiites, who are Arab, the Kurds, who are Sunnis but who are not Arabs, and then there are the Sunni Arabs. So they all have their own culture. They all have their own society. And it's kind of a three-legged stool. And the Sunnis, who dominate the whole Baghdad region, the Kurds to the north, the Shiites to the south, are really the key to Saddam's survival, mainly because they are the principal force in Baghdad, but because Saddam also is a Sunni, and he represents continuity to them. He represents nationhood. The Shiites have their own agenda. They think in terms the way Iran does, in terms of Islamic fundamentalism. The Kurds are turned toward their countrymen in Kurds in Turkey, Kurds in Iran, Kurds in Syria. It is basically the Sunnis who think of themselves as the Iraqi nation. And if the Kurds and the Shiites want to join, fine, they're glad to have them. But there is this sense of Iraqi nationhood that has come down through century after century. And I think these Sunnis are quite ready to overthrow Saddam because of the terrible brutality of the regime. Most of the people I talked to were Sunnis because they are the kinds of people you meet in Baghdad. They are the intellectuals and the professors and the people who run the shops and the kinds of people who you naturally find congenial and convenient to deal with. And they were much more fearful of the possibility of the disintegration of the country through the revolutions of the Kurds and the Shiites than they were worried about the brutality. That was their second priority. And when the Kurds and the Shiites started their uprising early in March, basically the Sunnis said, Listen, we really detest this guy, this Saddam Hussein. He has been brutal, miserable, and furthermore, he's been stupid in letting this war start from the first place. But we have an obligation to keep our country together, to keep the integrity and the unity of Iraq. And so they rallied around him. And this was totally predictable. I mean, it was not something that we had any right to be surprised by. Any medium-level scholar of the Middle East could have told President Bush that this was likely to happen.
You did a long interview with the former foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, when you were in Iraq. Was there anything he told you in the interview that made you see the events of the war or the events leading up to the war in a different light?
Tariq Aziz is a smart guy, and he is interesting to talk to. And I said to Tariq Aziz, you know, what did your government have in mind? Did you really think you were going to win this war? And he said, look, we were so angry at the United States for treating us with this contemptuousness, and we did our best to make overtures, and we thought we could negotiate this out. But President Bush not only refused to negotiate himself, but he managed to persuade all of his allies not even to talk with us. So the Soviet Union, we bumbled around with a few overtures with them, and that didn't work. The French, who were longtime friends of Iraq, wouldn't talk to us. The Germans, the Brits, all the others. And he said, you know, we got to the point where we looked at this as hopeless. And so I said, look, why didn't you throw in the towel and at least save the country? And he said, well, we thought our mindset was that our destiny had been set. There was no way for us to get out of it. And I sort of pulled at my hair and I said, look, the job of governments is to avoid this kind of destiny, of predestination that you were, I mean, you are, the Saddam Hussein government is a government which is known to take the initiative when it feels it is in trouble. Well, he said, we felt that there was nothing that we could do and we simply had to accept our fate. Well, I found that very unsatisfactory, and I still find it unsatisfactory, and I'm reporting to you basically what Tariq Aziz said to me. But there is that kind of strain of fatalism that exists within the Arab mind, and I think that Saddam Hussein was persuaded by, not by Tariq Aziz, because I'm convinced that Tariq Aziz, because he has this Western-style mind and he understands that you can, there are always maneuvers and there are always things that you can do and you can play this force against that force. I think when things really got tough, Saddam, like a good Iraqi country boy, decided he was going to rely on his family and his old friends, and they gave him a lot of stupid advice. And the advice they gave him seemed to be that we're just going to hold out and somehow God will take care of us or something of that sort. I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know. But that's the sense I have, that when it really came down to the end, it was like Hitler in the bunker, that reason no longer applied any longer, that what you did was what you thought you had to do, that the whole matter was out of your own hands. And as a Westerner, that I find that a kind of unsatisfactory way to deal with problems.
Do you think that there's going to be a next level of aftermath from the war in the Middle
East? Yeah, I think there's going to be a net level of aftermath. I remain convinced that the real threat to the interests of the United States lie with Iran. And Iran now no longer has the Iraqi army as a significant deterrent. Iraq is much weaker. Therefore, Iran is much stronger. We don't know what will happen. Iran has become a much greater influence in Kuwait and in Saudi Arabia. This is very dangerous, in my judgment, for the interests of the United States. What else has happened? I think the Sabah family, which is clearly the favorite of the president, he said repeatedly during the crisis that he was not concerned with bringing democracy to Kuwait. What he said was that he wanted to restore the legitimate government of Kuwait, this rather corrupt and inept, bumbling old family of Sabahs. They are now temporarily in power, but I don't have the impression that they can last more than, let's say, a year at the most. And I think if they fail, it's quite unclear how the interests of the United States will be affected. We have destabilized the whole region, in my judgment, by eschewing the opportunity to solve this problem by diplomacy and by going in and waging a war.
Well, Milton Vuorst, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Milton Vuorst is Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker magazine, and his article on his recent trip to Iraq is published in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing about further attempts by United Nations officials to inspect Iraqi nuclear sites, and we'll be talking about the possible significance of the nuclear technology that Iraq has. Also, news of New York City's countdown in its latest fiscal crisis. They've got to get budget cuts together by the end of this weekend. What Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall said in his news conference this morning about his decision to retire, and Senator John Danforth of Missouri's explanation of why he gave up the job of trying to mediate a compromise on new civil rights legislation, a compromise between Senate Democrats and the White House.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been following Marshall Crenshaw's career for the past 10 years, and he's excited by Crenshaw's new album, Life's Too Short. From it, here's Starting Tomorrow.
Starting tomorrow, if this night ever ends, bring on tomorrow, I'm gonna be heading back home again, and I know I'll feel more alive as soon as
Marshall Crenshaw's Life's Too Short is the most blissfully pure rock album in ages. It's also a summing up, the manifesto of a cult artist making mass audience music. For the past decade, Crenshaw has recorded pretty, catchy melodies and sung them in the voice of a callow teenager. But he's never made youth music. He's always recorded for his 30-something contemporaries, for a grown-up audience that gets all the references to the Beatles and Buddy Holly and all the one-hit wonders from the 60s and 70s. With his glasses, his sleepy smile, and his reedy voice, Crenshaw presents himself as a friendly guy who might be a wimp until you listen to him. 10 years ago, on his debut record, he moaned softly and accused a lover who had jilted him of being a cynical girl. And you realized quickly that that same word could describe his accusation. Their mutual cynicism convinced him that they were made for each other. But as the years go by, it's clear that Crenshaw is less a cynic than he is a realist. He never denies the complexity and ambivalence of any romance he sings about, and he seems truly to believe that with a good pop song, you can get to the heart of all emotional matters.
Last night we had a showdown that went on too long about four. God knows you sure surprised me. Sometimes I just don't know what to think anymore. But listen now, let's take a walk anyway. Let's go walking around.
That's Walkin' Around, whose pretty melody artfully obscures a sticky situation. In that song, Marshall and his partner take a silent stroll in the late afternoon, and typically, he's so happy, he's sad. Instead of enjoying the moment, he says, "My mind is racing. I don't want to see us end up with broken hearts." Like lots of good pop songwriters, Crenshaw takes a masochistic delight in feeling his own heart break. On the intense Don't Disappear Now, our hero, totally bereft of pride, is sitting by the phone waiting for his love to call. He remembers how their affair started with the coolest opening couplet around.
There is a certain appeal to danger and pain. When she whispered those words, I said, "What's your name?" Right then I knew in my heart that we shouldn't start. But there you go. But you mess up my mind. She looks so fine. I just had to know. So we got into her car and drove to her place. Stop making love for 30 long days. Until the telephone rang, my very soul, she did command. And all it took was a smile, the wink of her eye, the
It's always been obvious that Crenshaw loves women, loves them as sex objects, as conversationalists, as villains, as pals. And he's a rare songwriter who tries to describe feelings other than his own. In Better Back Off, he advises a woman to stop putting herself down. Quote, "Don't judge yourself so brutally. I can't stand it when you talk that way." The song slips into psychobabble that would be annoying if it wasn't so shrewd, and if the music, complete with Peter Case puffing on a harmonica, didn't rock so hard. Life's Too Short is Crenshaw's first collection on MCA after five albums of meticulously conceived, doomed work on Warner Brothers. The label change seems to have invigorated and emboldened him. He may be advising others to back off, but he's not. He knows that life's too short for him to be denied at least as much airplay as Michael Bolton.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Somewhere down.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week were Richard Parker and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about street gangs with Martin Sanchez-Jankowski, a sociologist who spent a decade studying gangs in Los Angeles, Boston, and New York. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.